From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. President Trump says he's considering an executive order to reinstitute plans for asking census takers whether they're U.S. citizens. What's the likelihood of the order standing? We'll talk with our political analysts. Later this hour, we hear from Ridgecrest residents about how they're dealing with the aftermath of the two large earthquakes last week. It all starts right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us today. Hope you had a good weekend. A very tough one for people in the Ridgecrest area. We're going to talk about the aftermath of the earthquakes that struck last Thursday and, of course, the one Friday night as well. That's later this hour. Also coming up in our second hour, the NBA. The focus shifts to Los Angeles. The Clippers with the huge free agent signing of Kawhi Leonard, fresh off his leading the Toronto Raptors to the NBA title. Paul George, another former Angelino who grew up here, joins Leonard with the Clippers and the Lakers, of course, with their stars. So we'll talk about what the NBA future holds. That's next hour. But we begin with the very latest in political news. President Trump saying last Friday he's considering an executive order to put a citizenship question on the upcoming U.S. Census. Also, the Department of Justice announcing that it is going to be swapping out the attorneys who represent the administration in the case before the federal courts. With us to talk about that and other big political stories, Amanda Renteria, the president of Emerge America, a national organization that identifies and trains Democratic women for political office. She also directed Hillary Clinton's political campaign in 2016 and has been a staffer for U.S. Senators Dianne Feinstein and Debbie Stabenow. Amanda, good to have you with us again. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Lonnie Chen of the Hoover Institution at Stanford University also with us. He's a research fellow at Hoover, and he advised both the Marco Rubio and Romney Ryan campaigns previously. Lonnie, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Let's start with the president seeking the executive order. Lonnie, let me start with you on this. He hasn't done it yet. He's talked about doing it. What do you think the odds are, though, that this would make its way through the courts?
Well, the odds are very high it would go to judicial review, because the key question in any executive order is what the statutory basis is. You've got to have a law on the books that you're basing executive action on, particularly an executive order, which is the most sacred, if you will, of executive actions, requires a justification that's linked to some law. And with respect to this particular situation, the census is one of those things, the administration of which traditionally has been left to Congress to oversee. The executive actually hasn't had a ton of leeway or leniency given to it in how it's actually carried out. So the question will be, what is the basis on which the Trump administration plans to seek executive action or an executive order? And if they do that, obviously people who oppose that executive order will challenge it in the courts, and it will go back through the judicial system again, and will consider whether the Trump administration's action was lawful with respect to using executive authority to do this sort of thing.
And where does the Supreme Court and its decision of a week and a half ago factor into this?
Well, the Supreme Court did leave open the possibility that there could be some justification for utilizing discretion to put in place a question that would look at citizenship status. I think the question is whether a justification exists, whether the administration is able to come up with that justification or not. So, you know, a lot of this is really getting down to interpreting a number of different things, including, as I said earlier, how much discretion the executive really has in this matter. So it will go back through the courts. There's no question about that. And it continues to be an issue that doesn't just have legal ramifications. Obviously, there are serious political ramifications, which is why we're talking about it. The question of how the census counts and whom it counts goes fundamentally to issues of how much money goes to various congressional districts and indeed who is counted within certain congressional districts. And that goes to the question of who has political control of the Congress and of state legislatures.
Amanda Renteria, your thoughts on the prospects of such an executive order if the president issues it?
Well, listen, this is, once again, the president using whatever kind of form or power he has to push the envelope and make sure that this is a discussion for his political benefit. And I think as we look at this and as we look at every other action that he does going forward, there's no doubt he is impulsive, and we've seen that. But there's also no doubt that he pushes the legality of anything possible. And as the election cycle starts to heat up, everyone should expect that we're going to continue to figure out where those lines are. And he will push it to the very end using the power of the presidency now. So this is going to be an ongoing debate, whether it's about the census or whether it's about any other legal executive orders he wants to put in. I think we're going to see more of this, not less. And we should get ready for it, both the courts, Congress, as well as the public who listens to what's happening on a daily basis.
The next night tonight, back-to-back debates with Democratic presidential candidates are the last week in July. The Democratic National Committee is making with each round of the debates more rigorous standards for the candidates to be able to qualify. That means they have to show that they have more support in various polls. They have to show that they're gaining fundraising strength as well. Amanda, I wanted to talk with you about that process, because do you think between now and the announcement of the candidates that qualify late this month, we're going to have some folks dropping out?
Absolutely. And in fact, there's already rumors today of Congressman Eric Swalwell thinking about doing that today. But you're also going to see some folks aren't going to hit that 130,000 threshold. And what do they do at this point? Particularly because, as you can tell, if you're not meeting those thresholds or if you're not making news, the campaign ends up moving away from you and the discussion ends up moving away from you. And I think, you know, the first person that drops out will have everyone question whether and why they're staying in. And so I think between now and the next debate, we'll see a couple folks step out or indicate that this will be their last debate if something doesn't change.
And are you seeing already the money backing Democratic candidates start to winnow itself out and coalesce around certain candidates? Or is it still as widely dispersed as it's been?
It's still pretty widely dispersed, but there's no doubt that you're seeing a change from that first debate where money went, whether people thought Senator Harris did really well or a backing off a little bit of Senator Biden. You see what happened. The biggest change really is what happened to Secretary Julian Castro, who today has said made that 130,000 threshold, but it was really based on what happened in the last debate. And so we're going to see more and more what happens from these debates and whether folks rise and fall. But at some point, you're just not making the cut. And that's certainly what every single campaign is going to go through. And you're going to, like I said, I think this is going to be the first announcement that comes out. But I think we'll see a couple of more before we get to the next debate.
Lonnie, how do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the summer before the primaries begin is obviously a very interesting period. If you look back to 2016, 2012, you know, there were some notable people who were in the race and made the decision not to continue for a variety of different reasons. I mean, oftentimes these folks might even be candidates who are considered very much viable. I mean, you think back to a guy like Tim Pawlenty, who was the governor of Minnesota and ran against Mitt Romney in 2012 and ended up dropping out toward the end of the summer because he couldn't get traction. The fundraising dried up. And for all sorts of different reasons, you're going to have different candidates seriously evaluating, particularly when the field is this big and particularly when you've got debates every month. And as we saw from the last debate, already you see that there are a separation between various candidates. And I think that certainly results in people reevaluating. So I absolutely expect a lot of turmoil in the field going between now and certainly the end of the summer as we cross that Labor Day mark when people really, really begin to tune in.
At the previous second night's debate between the candidates, there was an intense back and forth between Senator Kamala Harris and former VP Joe Biden over a couple of issues. One of them involved mandatory desegregation through court-ordered busing, and Senator Harris went after Joe Biden over his opposition to court-ordered busing. He also had previously touted his ability to work with people with whom he had stark disagreement. He mentioned working with a pair of senators who were segregationists, and that Biden was even willing to work with them later in their careers. He had said he wasn't going to apologize for having worked with those two senators, but on Saturday, this is what he said.
Was I wrong a few weeks ago to somehow give the impression to people that I was praising those men who I successfully opposed time and again? Well, yes, I was. I regret it. And I'm sorry for any of the pain or misconception they may have caused anybody.
Now, I don't recall Biden saying anything of praise about the two senators. His point was that even with people that he would have the most extreme disagreement, that he was still willing to work with them. So, Lonnie Chan, it's unclear to me with this apology. Is he just saying he didn't make that clear, that he strongly disagreed with the former segregationists? Or was it that was he apologizing that he had worked with segregationists? I'm still a little confused.
Yeah, Larry, I think your confusion is warranted. But look, I think one of the things that this signals was a shift in strategy from Biden and the Biden campaign. I mean, they obviously felt that they were at an unsustainable position. And whatever it was, he was going to get out there and issue some kind of blanket apology, such as the one he did, in an effort to put this issue behind them. Because whatever they were doing before certainly wasn't working. Whatever strategy was before, he was hemorrhaging at least support in the media. You know, obviously, the question of whether he was actually hemorrhaging real support, no one knows until voters actually go to cast their votes. But it was a marked shift in strategy. And I think in that sense, it's very important to see this as the Biden campaign recognizing in some ways that they have to step up and they have to conduct a different kind of campaign, because the campaign they were conducting, the campaign that Joe Biden was conducting going into that first debate and through that first debate, would not have been a sustainable one to get him to the nomination, in my opinion.
So, Amanda, does he need to go further in your view and say, I should have never worked with members of the Senate who had been segregationists in the past? Does he need to clarify, or does this move this out of the headlines?
I think people are going to continue to talk about this, but I think he's done all he can with this particular conversation. What I do think the campaign needs to do going forward is they just have to move faster. They have to be able to respond crisply, decisively when these moments arise, because what happened here, and I think every candidate goes through this, particularly if you've been in politics for a while, which is how do you describe the accomplishments you've had in the past with the world that is changing so quickly going forward? And remember, every election is about the future. And so being able to position your accomplishments in something you did, but being able to tie that to a future vision is going to be incredibly important. It has to happen in real time and quickly. And this one took a little longer than it probably should have.
Senator Kamala Harris responded saying he is right, meaning Joe Biden, to recognize the impact of his words. Excuse me. And I applaud him for doing that. This was during a press gaggle with reporters in Hartsville, South Carolina. She said there is still a point of disagreement between he and I, and that remains, which is the issue of busing. We cannot rewrite history about what segregationists were doing at that time on a number of issues, including opposing busing. Now, what's interesting is that Senator Harris has come out and clarified her remarks since the last debate and said that she doesn't necessarily favor court-ordered busing. She herself attributes voluntary busing in Berkeley as being a big advantage to her growing up and exposing her to all kinds of things as a student she wouldn't otherwise have had access to when she was growing up in the Bay Area. But anyway, Vice President, former VP Joe Biden spoke at length with CNN's Chris Cuomo several days ago about his performance in the debate and how he handled the criticism from Senator Harris.
What I didn't want to do is get in that scrum. Do you think the American public looked at that debate, take me out of it, and thought, boy, I really like the way that's being conducted. They're really showing themselves to do really well. Come on, man.
But they're going to come after you.
Sure, they're going to come after
you. Were you prepared for them to come after you?
I was prepared for them to come after me, but I wasn't prepared for the person coming at me the way she came at. She knew Bo. She knows me.
One of the things that we've heard from our GOP analyst who joins us regularly, Sean Walsh, he'd spoken with, you know, some of the people on the Biden staff, and they had wanted him to do rehearsals, debate prep and all. And he apparently had some reluctance to do all of that. Lonnie Chen, your thoughts about Biden expressing his surprise that he was confronted in such a way?
Yeah, well, he shouldn't have been surprised at all. I mean, the reality is that when you come into that debate stage, when you get onto that debate stage in that first debate as the putative front runner, or at least when the polls suggest you're the front runner, you know you're going to take some incoming. And I think the question was whether, in fact, he sort of thought, look, I'm going to take the incoming, but I know how to deal with it. Or whether, you know, he wasn't properly prepared by his staff. For whatever reason, it was pretty clear that that debate performance probably wasn't one that they care to repeat. In some ways, though, what happened almost doesn't matter now, given that there's another debate just a few weeks away, and the news cycle changes with such rapidity that I just have a tough time seeing that sticking unless he has another moment like the one he had in the first debate. Then it becomes a trend and it becomes a problem. But clearly something went wrong there, whether in the prep or whether, you know, sometimes candidates don't want to prep and they don't want to do the things that their staff tells them. And that's okay. They're the candidate. They're entitled to do that. But usually experience demonstrates kind of what the best way forward is. So for the Biden campaign, I would presume they believe that some kind of change in strategy or some kind of change, certainly in tone, is necessary going into the second debate in a few weeks.
JSK writes on our AirTalk page, kpcc.org, seems to me Senator Harris adopted the position of Joe Biden after criticizing him for it. Yeah, it kind of seemed that way to me, JSK. But then she said today that they still disagree on busing. So it's yet another issue that I'm confused on. Amanda Renteria, can you clear that up?
I can't, to be honest. It seems very nuanced to me. What I think is going on here is Senator Harris would like to continue this conversation. I think as you continue this conversation, her pointing out really Biden's inability to respond directly to her in a way that I think the public saw as appropriate, she'd like to continue that conversation. But from a policy perspective, it doesn't seem that they're quite different here. It was much more about approach and the personal response that she had. And really, Biden didn't address that personal response. And so I think it will be very interesting to see whether or not this continues as a policy conversation going forward or as a broader conversation about the impact on in people of color in the education field or something along those broader lines.
And it's so odd, isn't it? 50 years after these decisions came down and, you know, busing hasn't been a front and center political issue in decades. And here this becomes a focal point of the last Democratic candidates debate. Well, we'll continue our conversation with Amanda Renteria, the president of Emerge America, and Lonnie Chen, Hoover Institution at Stanford research fellow. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd interviewed Nancy Pelosi and asked the House Speaker about opposition to a border funding bill that came from four relatively new members of the House, Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan. And the response that Pelosi is quoted by Dowd as saying is all these people have their public whatever in their Twitter world, but they didn't have any following. They're four people, and that's how many votes they got. Ocasio-Cortez answered on Twitter by saying that public, quote, whatever is called public sentiment, and wielding the power to shift it is how we actually achieve meaningful change in this country. Congresswoman Tlaib said, why would we fund a broken system that rips children away from their parents, deny asylum seekers due process, and fuels a racist ideology that dehumanizes people? She also said it would be better if the House Speaker focused on Mitch McConnell, her counterpart in the Senate, as opposed to members of her own party. Amanda, what do you think of this? And were the comments by the House Speaker very, you know, clearly intended to be a shot across the bow of the four, sometimes referred to as the squad?
You know, as I read her comments, what I read is someone trying to pass legislation, and having spent so much time on the Hill as a chief of staff, that just responsibility to do something about it, to act and to make sure something passes, is really where I took her comments to come from. While the comments of the four women, you know, what they seem to be doing is trying to change the consciousness of the party as well as this country. And that takes time. And that means you're also always pushing where we are today. And I think the real challenge for the Democratic Party and Speaker Pelosi is how do you bridge that over the next, you know, 6 months, over the next year, while we're going through a presidential campaign?
Lonnie Chen, what do you think?
Yeah, it's. I agree absolutely. I think it's difficult for Speaker Pelosi to figure out what the right way is to bring together disparate parts of her party, and this is a challenge that party leaders have. Oftentimes, the Democrats are experiencing it in the context of their presidential primary. The Republicans will experience it when President Trump leaves office, I think. But it is, I think, for Speaker Pelosi, a huge challenge, and one that she's handled pretty well, if you ask me. I mean, I think she's had a very, very strident group of people in her caucus who have wanted to move things in a different direction, and she has seen her responsibility as getting things done, doing the best she can to do what needs to be done to keep the functioning of government, you know, as high as it can be in this era of intense political division. And you know, she's got a very, very, as I said, strident and active group of people who want to move things in a different direction. So she's done well.
Is there a precedent for this among Republicans where you had a longtime either House Speaker or majority leader in the Senate and, for lack of a better term, rabble-rousing group of newcomers who've, you know, put the head of the House or Senate into a difficult spot?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think you see this continuously. You know, you saw it with John Boehner and the Tea Party, and which, you know, eventually became the Freedom Caucus. You saw it with Paul Ryan and the Freedom Caucus. Now, obviously, both Boehner and Ryan did not serve in those roles as for as long a period of time as Pelosi has. But, you know, they were in the Congress for a long period of time. They were well-known entities amongst Republicans. And that split that you saw within the Republican conference on the House side, certainly throughout the 2010s and the 2000s, reflected a split within the Republican Party about what kind of party it should be, how they should work with or not work with an incumbent president of a different party. So it's not certainly something that's limited to the Democrats, and you can even go back in history farther with Republicans and see the way in which you had long-serving Republican leaders have to deal with these challenges from the wings of the party, which, by the way, I think speaks interestingly enough to Mitch McConnell's skill as the leader of the Senate Republicans, that he's managed to stay in there given some similar dynamics on the Senate side with Republicans and the divisions within the party there.
I want to talk about President Trump and the 4th of July parade with the flyovers, the speech the president made last Thursday. There was heavy criticism going into that event. There hadn't been quite as much afterwards. But Lonnie, do you think that the event that the president held, that there was a lasting effect from that?
I don't think so. I think it served to cement, his supporters' disdain for people who oppose the president, and I think it also served to reinforce those who oppose the president's their disdain for him. I mean, the reality is that, the president had a celebration for the 4th of July that was different from what previous presidents have done. There were a couple stories that cropped up around that. The event happened, I think, largely without too many noteworthy things happening, with the exception of the gaffe in his speech where he talked about taking over the airports during the Revolutionary War. But these kinds of things can happen, and I don't think it's going to have a lasting impact. I think if anything, it reflects, as I said, the division we have in our political culture, and people will see that celebration through the lens of how they see President Trump, and I think that's the where our politics is now.
Amanda Renteria, what do you think ultimately came of this event?
I think we will look back on this as really a diversion to what really happens on 4th of July. I've spent many years going to the 4th of July events, and what it starts out with is actually a reading of the Declaration of Independence around this idea of those words and what were written. And what's interesting about it is it ends with, "But do not destroy the immortal emblem of humanity." And when you think about how far we are from that moment where you have tanks in the street and kids in cages, you begin to go, where are we? And what I think we will look back on this as is a different time and something that really did change from what we were about and the ideal and the idea of America.
Also wanted to talk about the Friday economic news, where more than 200,000 jobs were added. It continues to show the economy overall doing very well. President Trump, though, has not been able to leverage the strong economy, and shows, his public opinion numbers staying fairly consistent. Amanda, your thoughts on those Friday job numbers and what would be typically a boon to an incumbent president?
I think it's the typical things for this administration are always going to be difficult because of how much attention he gets for all the other kind of distractions that he creates. And so one would argue that a good, strong economic forecast or number out there would always help. But in today's world, it's a little bit different. News is moving so fast, and in some ways, economic numbers are almost boring relative to some of the other things that he's been doing as part of the administration.
And it was funny, even with the tax cut, with the change in the withholding rules, the majority of Americans, even those who ended up paying less total tax, perceived that they did less well under the tax changes. Lonnie Chen, can the president in any way capture this economy to his benefit?
Yeah, I think this is going to be the animating question of the election, quite frankly, Larry. There was a poll that came out over the weekend that the Washington Post did where, essentially the conclusion is if the election is about President Trump, he's going to have a difficult time. If the election is about President Trump and how he's handled certain elements of policy, like the economy, most notably, he's got a very good chance at winning re-election. And I think this speaks to the challenge that you have, because in a normal, more normal pre-Trump administration, you would see the president out there talking about the economy and really trying to focus his attention on how do we capitalize on these economic numbers in that way. And I think this president, tends not to be quite as focused on that message. And so it'll be interesting to see if he can win in spite of what should be, these really good numbers and a way of trumpeting them. But look, the economy, I think, is quite resilient, but it's tough to just look at 1 month's jobs numbers and say, look, this is what's happening with the economy. You have to look at a trend. And ultimately, what will be more important for President Trump is the trend going into the election next year. Is the economy improving or declining? President Obama took a rising economy to victory in 2012, even though the numbers objectively weren't great. The improvement, I think, was what mattered. And so we'll have to see where this goes next year. But I think the economy will be a big factor in this election one way or the other.
Amanda, quick thought from you about Iran with its announcement that it's enriching uranium past the level agreed to in the multinational nuclear agreement. What do you think of the implications for the U.S.?
You know, I whenever we start talking about the international conversations or what this country is doing, what this president is doing, I worry because this is exactly the moments where we need our intelligence agency, we need our foreign military officials or our military officials to really step up and work with the president. This is usually when they are best at their work. This is usually when the country comes together to figure out what next steps are. My concern is that not everyone is on the same page. And I think we're going to see that again as we get to the end of this agreement. What do we do now?
All right. Amanda Renteria, always a pleasure. Thank you for being with us. President,
thank you for having me on.
Emerge America, which works to identify and train Democratic women for political office. She was national political director for Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign. Also, for a number of years, was senatorial staffer. Lonnie Chen, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, also advised the Rubio 2016 and Romney 2012 campaigns. Coming up, the very latest from Ridgecrest. We'll talk about the powerful earthquakes and how the towns of Ridgecrest and Trona are trying to come back. Back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Coming up next hour on Air Talk, the end of new content in Mad Magazine. For people of my age group, baby boomers, Mad was hugely influential. And in fact, you could argue they influenced a whole generation of comedy writers, comedians. Their satires of television and film were really the first of its kind. And, you know, TV was a fairly new medium at the time when Mad Magazine got a hold of it and did just classic spoofs of shows like Star Trek and Dr. Kildare, and you name it, some of these early television programs. But right now, we turn our attention to a far more serious topic, the pair of large earthquakes that struck near Ridgecrest in California's Mojave Desert. On Thursday, 4th of July, 6.4 magnitude earthquake at 10:33 in the morning. Then around 8:20 on Friday night, a 7.1 magnitude quake, which informed us that Thursday's was a foreshock of Friday night's even bigger earthquake. We went on the air live for more than 2 hours Friday night, and we talked with a number of Ridgecrest residents about how they were feeling. Understandably, their nerves were jangled. For many of them, they weren't going back in their homes or apartments for fear of aftershocks and additional damage, staying in their front driveways or lawns, not wanting to go back in their homes. We're going to talk with some Ridgecrest residents now a few days later about how they're coping. But first, with me from the Shake Alert Earthquake Early Warning Project at the U.S. Geological Survey in Pasadena, Robert DeGroot, staff scientist there. Robert, good to have you with us again.
Good morning. Thank you.
I want to talk a bit about the research that's now going on. I know on Thursday that teams went up to look at the original surface rupture from that earthquake along Highway 187, I believe it is, to see what the damage was. Now we have damage that reportedly was at the China Lake Naval Weapons Facility. What do you know at this point about the importance of the work on the bigger earthquake to see the surface rupture?
So it's one thing to get the data from the field, from the seismometers, but it's also extremely important to send field crews out there to look at what's happening out there to get a real sense of the extent of the damage of the earthquake. It also gives us a sense of potentially what may happen next. So it's important to get people in the field all the time.
And what are some of the things they're going to be looking for about, you know, from just that rupture and visible surface evidence?
Yeah, any telltale signs of, you know, road breaks, the actual ruptures in the ground itself, also a survey of the damage that has been done. We have colleagues from the California Governor's Office of Emergency Services out there talking to residents. So it also informs us in future preparations for earthquakes, which is extremely important.
And what is your sense of the potential for additional very large quakes looking at the Garlock Fault, a lesser known fault, which is 10 or 11 miles south of mm-hmm. where these quakes have taken place, and its potential interaction with the San Andreas.
Yes, we haven't gotten a lot of information about the potential for another fault being triggered, such as the San Andreas. I mean, where the earthquakes occurred is pretty far away from the San Andreas itself. What we have been talking a lot about are the potential for earthquakes that are larger than the 7.1, and that's still just a few percent. It's not large, and it continues to decrease as time goes on.
All right. We have with us Sarah Macedo, a resident of Ridgecrest. Sarah is currently staying in Lake Tahoe. She had mentioned to us Friday night that they were headed the next day on a vacation. Sarah, thank you for joining us again. Are you feeling at all emotionally back to normal, or still pretty shook up?
I think still pretty shook up. I mean, I've been able to get a little bit of sleep as opposed to the night after I first spoke to you. A couple hours after we first talked, the fire broke out behind our house. So that kind of like set me on edge. Luckily that was put out, but I didn't sleep a wink after that. And we were supposed to wait for my parents to get there and hit the road, but my husband and I just decided to leave like at 4 a.m. and just get going. The nerves were just too much and just feeling nauseous and that, but just grateful to not be there for the time being until Friday, until they go back.
Yeah, and as I recall, you have animals, right? Where are they?
We have two dogs and a cat. They're staying with our parents in L.A., so I'm really lucky that they weren't there. We were just talking about leaving our cat with my folks for at least like maybe another few weeks, because it'd be feel like it'd be harder to get the cat out of the house as opposed to the two dogs who I could just wrangle up. So,
and have you talked with your landlord? As I recall, you're renting the property. Have you spoken with your landlord about the extent of damage to your place?
We talked to him. He was out of town. He just got back yesterday, and he's going to go over and look at the house because we haven't seen it, you know, in a couple of days. And I know there's been a lot of tremors because I've been in contact with a lot of friends over there and just keeping up with the Ridgecrest Facebook page. So he's going to go over and have a look. Honestly, I'm not sure. I'm just, I'm honestly afraid to go back into the house, to be honest with you. So
what are you going to do if, I think you said Friday, you're done with a vacation to Tahoe. What are you going to do if you feel like you're just not emotionally ready to go back?
We're probably going to take the weekend and stay in, you know, the Pasadena area with family. And then Sunday assess what we do. My husband works on base, so I guess it depends, too, whether, you know, he has to go back to work. I mean, I could have the option of staying with our son and our dog, like, in Pasadena, but I also don't want to just leave him, like, down there.
Yeah. Would you go so far as to consider leaving Ridgecrest? I don't know if if you have jobs there and that you're tethered there, but would you consider either leaving Ridgecrest or California after this?
Obviously that was a thought that crossed like our minds, but we've moved quite a bit in the last couple of years that I'm not sure, you know, like if we want to do that. Like it's, there's just a lot. I think like right now we're just still trying to process because yeah. Ridgecrest is the last place, because we grew up in LA and it's like honestly the last place that I would have ever thought that a major earthquake would have taken place. Of course, I'm not a scientist, you know, but it's just, it's the last thing that you would ever thought. Nobody thinks they're going to be like in a crazy natural disaster like that.
Well, yeah, there's no way of predicting where that's going to happen. Sarah, thank you for being with us. I'm going to let you go. You're on vacation and want to allow you a chance to get back to enjoying it as best you're able. Thank you for sharing your thoughts, being so open with us, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Sarah Macedo, resident of Ridgecrest, currently at Lake Tahoe. Let me go back to our guest, seismologist on the program and staff scientist for the Shake Alert Earthquake Early Warning Project, USGS, Robert DeGroot. Robert, I mean, one of the things, if you're going to live in California, there is no place you could move where you're going to be assured of avoiding heavy shaking.
That's right. So California is earthquake country. So being prepared is part of being a Californian.
It just comes with the territory. I remember, though, after the Northridge earthquake, I knew people who'd actually moved out of state.
Yes.
They just felt emotionally they could not handle another one.
Yes.
All right. We're going to continue with more residents of Ridgecrest as they share their experiences with us. Robert DeGroot with us as well. We're going to get an update on what's happening in the community so hard hit by Thursday 6.4 and Friday night 7.1 magnitude earthquakes. We're also going to talk about the intensity of the ground shaking, because the Richter scale doesn't necessarily tell you what the ground shaking is. It's a little more complicated than that. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Pardon me. We're talking about the earthquakes of Thursday and Friday, centered near Ridgecrest, also the small town of Trona in the Mojave Desert, heavily hit by the impact of those two earthquakes, not to mention all the aftershocks, which are an important part of these quakes, because the emotional effect of the continuous shaking, even if the aftershocks aren't as big as the larger ones, there's that sense, if you've gone through a series of quakes, that you can't ever sort of relax. That fight or flight instinct kicks in. The adrenaline starts pumping because you're constantly having the upset that comes with the aftershocks. With us next is Alexis Zubia, a Ridgecrest resident, who joins us. Thank you very much, Alexis. Share with us how you're doing.
Thanks. I'm actually doing well. We actually just got another aftershock as we speak. I'm doing fine, honestly. The most terrifying was the 7.1, only because I was by myself and inside an office, which I now know is not earthquake proof. So there's going to have to be some changes, but I'm pretty thankful that, you know, my apartment as well as my parents' house held up pretty well. I'm actually here at my other job too, the radio station, which we held up pretty well. Unfortunately, some of our stations actually did go off air and a bunch of things did break. But we're lucky to have everything back into place and everything like that.
That's good. I think I when I was starting out in radio, worked for one of the stations in Lancaster, as I recall. So it's funny. But some of them actually went off the air. So do you have them all back on?
Yes. If I can believe, 87.7 Kicking Country is the only one that we're having trouble getting back on. But we have all the other stations back on, like 92.7 and 100.9 The Heat. So luckily, those are our main stations where people gather information from, and those are all back on.
How about your apartment? How did it fare?
It actually did pretty well. Luckily, my brother was the only one staying there at the time, and we're very thankful he was actually in his room, because we have knives, and they all fell on the ground from the refrigerator. And so that was a little worrisome, because if he had been standing there, you know, who knows if those would have caught him. But everything else held up pretty well. My big mirror did fall and break, but everything else seemed to be good, besides, you know, some little tiny knickknacks broke, but nothing major, just materialistic things and stuff like that.
And are the stores cleaned up and reopened, or are a number of them still closed as they deal with the damage?
From my knowledge, most of them, like I went to Stater Brothers, that one's open. The new Albertsons is open. I heard Walmart was open. The one place I did hear was the older Albertsons. It took a pretty big hit, as it is on the north side of Ridgecrest. So I'm not sure if they're open right now as we speak, but I do know that they did take one of the bigger hits.
Alexis, thanks very much. We wish you well and appreciate your talking with us about your community. Alexis Zubia, Ridgecrest resident. Also with us, Larry Cox, senior pastor of the First Baptist Church in Trona. That town, which is smaller than Ridgecrest, hit very hard. Pastor Cox, thank you for being with us. How did your church building come through?
Structurally, our church building actually did quite well. We have three buildings on the property, the parsonage, the sanctuary, and the fellowship hall. Structurally, we did quite well. It did pull away a little bit from the sidewalks and so on. The most of the damage was really inside. We have the main part of the fellowship hall, a large open room, and the entire ceiling collapsed inside there, as well as in our ladies' room. And then, of course, in our hallway, we had some of the drywall come down. And that is the major point of the damage in our buildings.
Were you able to have your service in your sanctuary yesterday?
Yes, believe it or not, you know, as much as we got hit, you know, our house, of course, was a mess. The fellowship hall was a tremendous mess. But when we walked into the sanctuary, not even a picture was out of place. Nothing was off the shelves. Everything was, you know, in almost as if the earthquake never happened. We have a lot of pictures of our missionaries and so on hanging up. And they weren't even out of order. They weren't even leaning or anything. And so we were able to just pick up where we left off in that. We usually have three services a day. We did have to tone it down to just one service, as many of our people are gone, and others are off helping different parts of the community. But we did have an 11 a.m. service yesterday.
And was the turnout for that decent?
Yeah, we had probably about half our people. We have a congregation, just a little over 100 people, and I would say we probably had 30 to 45 of those that were there yesterday.
Have you been contacted by any of your congregants asking to talk with you, providing pastoral counseling, or because of the trauma of experiencing these two big earthquakes?
Well, I've had a few of them call me and ask what they, you know, they were thinking about leaving and just going away, away from the earthquake for a few days. And I told them I thought that that was wise because they had little, most of them had all had little children. We have several military in our church as well. They had to go. The military base here moved them over to Ventura or Fresno. And so they left. But, you know, our people were pretty strong through this, and they did quite well. And immediately after the earthquake, all of our people, are the men and women in our church, immediately started to fan out to find out that the elderly and the shut-ins and so on were all right. And so we fared, you know, physically and mentally, I think, quite well, emotionally quite well through all of this.
All right. And Pastor Cox, just real quickly, the extent of the damage in Trona, do you have a sense of how many structures are needing to be further examined or aren't habitable now?
Yes, I spoke with the fire department yesterday, and they told me that they believe there's roughly 40 that have been red tagged so far. And of course, they're still going through. We even had inspectors as well as engineers come through our buildings to make sure it was all right. I just left one of the men in our church, his Benny Eldridge and his wife. They have been members of our church since really since 1955. His parents actually built our church, and their house was absolutely destroyed. They have moved out. It is leaning off to one side about 4 or 5 inches. All the walls inside have pretty well cracked and crumbled. And so they're right at this point packing up and having to leave. We've heard that with a few others. We've driven around town. We have seen kind of similar stories, people with U-Hauls and big trucks in front of their homes pulling stuff out and having to move out.
Pastor Cox, thank you very much for sharing with us what your community's endured with these two earthquakes. We appreciate it. He's senior pastor of First Baptist Church in Trona, Larry Cox, with us. Let me go back to Robert DeGroote of the U.S. Geological Survey Earthquake Science Center in Pasadena. We're going to be having aftershocks going on for months, right?
For a very long time, yes.
And what advice do you have just for people to sort of, you know, prepare themselves for the ongoing effects?
So we've heard so many great stories today, and, you know, our hearts go out to the folks in the Ridgecrest area. And we just want people to know what to do to protect themselves, to take a protective action such as drop cover and hold on. And just be safe.
All right. Also want to remind you the big one, the KPCC podcast, critically acclaimed, much downloaded, is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can hear the big one, multiple sources. We encourage you to download it and get prepared for future earthquakes in Southern California. Robert DeGruy, thank you so much for being with us. Much more to come in the second hour of Air Talk. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you had a wonderful weekend. We appreciate your being with us. Maybe you've got 4 days because of the Thursday Independence Day holiday. Coming up this hour, we're going to take a look at the future of Mad Magazine. It had an extraordinary past, the magazine highly influential in American comedy. We'll remember Mad Magazine with listener calls and also experts on American comedy. But first, we begin with another huge entertainment story, and that is the focal point of the coming NBA season is the Los Angeles Clippers and the Los Angeles Lakers, the two NBA franchises, both with big deals, arguably the Clippers with the bigger news of the two, signing native Angelino Kawhi Leonard, who just led his Toronto Raptors team to the NBA title. But it's not just Leonard who arrives in L.A. to play for the Clippers pulling off a big trade to obtain Paul George, the Oklahoma City Thunder star, who also is an L.A. native. So the two, George and Leonard, will be playing side by side for the Clippers. The Lakers, who had wanted Leonard, instead as a consolation sign big man DeMarcus Boogie Cousins to a front court already stacked with LeBron James and the recently acquired Anthony Davis. Kyle Kuzma, budding young Lakers star, also joins that Laker lineup. With us to talk about these huge changes, Dan Wieke, who's national NBA writer for the Los Angeles Times. Dan, good to have you with us.
We should just take a moment and appreciate how good of a nickname Boogie is.
Isn't that a great nickname? I love it.
It is such a good nickname. It's something I think there aren't enough good ones in sports anymore. Like, there's a lot of bad ones. Boogie is maybe my favorite.
It is a great one. Not that DeMarcus is too shabby either, but no, you're absolutely right. So the Clippers, the huge winners here, and give us a little bit of background how this all worked behind the scenes, because it seems that Kawhi Leonard and or his representatives put this together.
Yeah, so it really all kind of goes back to when the Clippers traded Blake Griffin to Detroit. And you know, they had targeted the summer of 2019 as a time when they wanted to be financially flexible enough to sign one, if not two, top free agents. And they very quickly identified Kawhi Leonard as somebody that they wanted. And this year, throughout the season, it was not a secret that the Clippers were interested in Kawhi Leonard. They would have executives scouting Toronto Raptors games when, you know, the Clippers only play the Raptors twice a year. You don't need to scout them as much as the Clippers were scouting, but it was about being a presence and it was about being around. I was covering the Eastern Conference Finals and the Clippers sent an executive up from Chicago where the NBA draft combine was to go to a Milwaukee Bucks Toronto Raptors playoff game just to be seen. You know, that's the only reason to do it. And they did this all year. They were very overt about it, much, you know, to the chagrin sometimes of people in Toronto. And I think they had a very good working relationship with Kawhi Leonard's representatives. And, you know, it was made known to them. Like, the Clippers wanted two stars. Like, let's just start with that. They I think that the plan A would have been to get Kevin Durant and Kawhi Leonard. And I think that was Kawhi Leonard's plan. Once Kevin Durant committed to Brooklyn and made it known that he was going to team up with Kyrie Irving, they went looking for a second superstar. They landed pretty quickly on Paul George, who was under contract in Oklahoma City, and the Clippers kind of had to pay a king's ransom to get him. But I think it was, you know, this was a testament to the power that players have in this league and their ability to kind of work together and try to find situations where they can go and win together. And the Clippers, to the surprise of a lot of people, you know, who haven't been paying that much attention, are now a place that superstars want to go. And this is a huge win for their franchise to be sort of chosen by Kawhi Leonard and Paul George.
Couple of native Southern Californians returning home. George is from Palmdale, Leonard from Riverside, mm-hmm. so they would have grown up presumably Lakers fans, but both of them are now members of the Clippers. Also with us is Miriam Swanson, beat reporter for the LA Clippers for the Southern California News Group. Miriam, thank you for being with us. Share with us a little more about the behind the scenes. The Clippers did give up a lot to get Paul George, including a very promising young guard who had a wonderful rookie season.
Oh, absolutely. And just real quick on Dan's point about Boogie, I have a six-year-old son, and his new favorite player in L.A. is Boogie Cousins. Just
because of the name.
There's a player named Boogie, or called Boogie. But yeah, the Clippers, you know, the King's ransom that Dan referred to, it really was. They gave up not only five draft picks and a couple of potential pick swaps, but Danilo Gallinari, who had a great year last year, and maybe most importantly, and missed most by Clipper fans already, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. He was a rookie point guard from Canada last year, and he's super smooth and fun to watch and a hard worker, and the Clippers really, really loved him, and Doc really, you know, got a lot out of him, and they expect a lot from him. So I know giving him up was hard, and, you know, the understanding was kind of that he was, you know, close to untouchable even, but I think in this case, if it means getting Paul George, and by getting Paul George it means getting Kawhi Leonard, you know, that makes sense.
Well, and maybe if it was just Paul George, they don't make that deal and give up so much. You could argue they overpaid for Paul George, mm-hmm. but they needed Paul George, didn't they, to get Kawhi Leonard?
Sure seems as though, yeah. And yeah, it's a pretty good package. And you know, that's, it's a lot of picks, but I mean, how many of them are going to be Paul George's and Kawhi Leonard's down the road?
Yeah, good point. Miriam Swanson, Clippers beat reporter, SoCal News Group. Dan Wyke, national NBA writer for the LA Times. Our phone lines are open to hear what you think about this, whether you're a Clipper or a Laker fan. 866-893-KPECC. And of course, because the teams are in the same division, they play each other multiple times, all the games at Staples Center, the arena that they share. This is going to be such an exciting season. And Dan, it also is going to point up because, you know, none of these players are kids anymore. Health, who is able to keep their stars healthy is going to be a big determiner of success this year.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I mean, I think this is one of the things that, you know, Kawhi Leonard famously in the Toronto Raptors kind of brought the term load management into the sort of nomenclature of the NBA. And essentially what that is instead of having a guy play all 82 games in the regular season, you kind of pick and choose nights that he's going to take off and that he's not going to play. And Kawhi Leonard was around 60 games last year. I would guess that would maybe be ramped up slightly, but not much. I would think that that is kind of the plan. I would anticipate the Clippers do it with Paul George too. And I think, you know, you have this depth on their roster that they've built, and they've been a very good team, you know, without these guys. This is essentially the same team that won 48 games last year. Everybody's back, except instead of Danilo Gallinari and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who are very good players, you have MVP-caliber players in Paul George and Kawhi Leonard replacing them. I think we'll see it with the Lakers, too. I think LeBron James and Anthony Davis will both also, you know, get scheduled nights off. And this is one of the upsides to having multiple stars, is that you can win one game, you know, here or there in the NBA season without your best player. Toronto was masterful at this last year without Kawhi Leonard. And I think what it did, too, is it helped other young players step up and take on bigger roles and become more important to winning. And that paid off as they won their championship. I think this will be really important for the Clippers, particularly because they do have a lot of young players. The Lakers, not as many. They have Kyle Kuzma, who will have to, I think, on these sort of load management nights, take on a really big role offensively. But it's an interesting challenge as the league kind of kicks around the idea of shortening the season or figuring out other ways to try to get a hold of this. I think you're only going to see more and more teams employ sort of the strategy because, yeah, it would be great to have a good seed in the playoffs, but you want your guys playing their best basketball and their healthiest at their healthiest come the postseason, and that's what Toronto did successfully. And this is a copycat league, and I anticipate a lot of teams trying to mimic that strategy.
You know, if this was a couple years ago, much would be made about Cousins signing with the Lakers. He comes off a couple of injuries, one of them very serious. And the question is, can he, you know, get himself physically back to where he was when he was averaging 25 points a game? And, you know, what are the schools have thought about it? It's a 1 year, you know, prove he's healthy contract. So he's, you know, he's got a lot of incentive to take care of himself and have a strong year. But Dan, what's the thought about the potential with Cousins?
Well, it's really, you know, everybody kind of who comes off of this Achilles injury says it's at least a 2 year recovery, right? And last year was his first year of those 2 years, that it takes a while to get back to your former self. And I think this is a really big gamble by Rob Pelinka, because fairly or unfairly, DeMarcus has been painted as somebody who isn't always the easiest person to be around, that he can be kind of a little bit of a headache for teams. He's a really passionate player. I wouldn't say I know him well, but I've spent some time with him. And you know, I think he's someone who can impact winning, but it comes with a cost. You know, like, he is someone you have to deal with. He is someone you have to be aware of. And, you know, you wonder how willing he is, if he's going to come off the bench, if he's going to share minutes with JaVale McGee. How willing is he to accept a diminished role? Because, like you said, before that Achilles injury, this guy was one of the best centers in the NBA. You know, maybe the most offensively gifted center in the NBA. And he's not that anymore. You know, the league has changed a lot in this time that he's been hurt. And now in some ways he's kind of a big slow guy, and that's not always that good. So I think trying to maybe transition him, I wrote something today, in almost like a relief pitcher in baseball, a guy that doesn't have to hold back, that can come in and play 7-8 minute spurts and just throw fastball after fastball, not worry about getting tired, not worried about what it's going to be in minute 10. If he can kind of harness some of his energies, I think he could be this devastating bench scorer. We'll see if that's a role, though. I mean, a player that good accepting a diminished role, it's always a hard sell. And I think it'll be a really interesting challenge for the Lakers to kind of figure out the best way to use DeMarcus Cousins.
Yeah, and in a contract year for him, of course. Chad and Irvine, your thoughts about where this leaves our two local NBA teams?
Yeah, so I think people are very excited at where the Clippers are at, or obviously with Kawhi Leonard and Paul George, but I'm really excited to see the depth that this Lakers team has, especially with the Danny Green acquisition and Boogie Cousins, Avery Bradley this morning, and I think they have a pretty deep team going into the season. I think it'll be really exciting to see the two teams battle it out, especially with the rest of the league.
Yeah, Chad, all right, thanks. Thanks very much. Now, are you a Laker fan?
You know, I have been a lifelong Lakers fan. Yes, I have.
Yeah, okay, you're like me. But I always like to see the Clippers do well, too. To me, it's not zero-sum game. And I've said I'm going to watch a lot more Clippers games this year than in the past. Chad, I appreciate it very much. We're talking with Miriam Swanson, who's the Clippers beat writer for the Southern California News Group, Dan Wyke, national NBA writer for the Los Angeles Times. Like to hear from you, whether you're a fan of the Clippers or the Lakers or both. What do you think of these teams and their big additions in the offseason? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jack in Zurich writes on the page, if you're a tinfoiler prone to conspiracy theories, the buzz is the Kawhi Leonard delayed announcing he was coming to the Clippers in order to jam up the Lakers from signing any of the quality talent during that period, since they assumed he would sign with them and needed the salary cap space. Miriam Swanson, can you comment on that?
I've obviously that is a conspiracy theory out there. From the sounds of it, though, there were some dealings that the Clippers were making, and it was quite a trade that they needed to figure out how to get through with Oklahoma City. And reportedly, the Raptors also were involved with that. So I think there was a lot of back and forth and a lot of negotiating happening behind the scenes, and maybe a little recruiting on Kawhi's part too, to you know, because he had to convince or persuade Paul George to ask to be traded, even though apparently the two of them, or Paul George talked to reporters in Oklahoma last year, saying that he and Kawhi had spent some time over the summer and talked about, you know, both being Southern California guys and, you know, not playing there. But
yeah,
So I think that, you know, the seeds for this were maybe planted a little while, you know, maybe months ago. But I think it was a complicated deal that needed to happen and a lot of moving pieces. And of course, per Kawhi, and it all was very quiet. We didn't really know much about what was happening until it happened. And surprise, surprise. But,
yeah. Miriam, one of the things about Kawhi, it said, you know, when he was with San Antonio, you get his uncle when you get Kawhi, that he's sort of the spokesman for Kawhi Leonard and has a very prominent role in Leonard's life. Are the Clippers, do you know what kind of relationship they've got with his uncle?
It must not be bad.
Clearly, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know that Uncle Dennis, as he's known, was involved with all of the negotiations and the process in the last, you know, few weeks and months and years, but especially lately. And, you know, from what I understand, that they've got a good relationship with Doc Rivers and with the rest of the Clippers front office. So
it is so funny in the modern NBA, when you get the player, you don't just get the player, you get his family member or his agent, or, you know, it's sort of the team that comes with the player to the team.
Support system.
Yes, absolutely. We'll continue our conversation with Miriam Swanson of the Southern California News Group, Dan Wykeith, Los Angeles Times. Love to hear from you as a Laker or Clipper fan, your analysis of the big deals made by both teams, arguably the Clippers with the more impressive of the two, signing, if not the top player in NBA today, certainly one of the top three, Kawhi Leonard. We'll be back in 1 minute. I think it's safe to say television ratings for our two NBA teams should be considerably higher for the 2019-20 upcoming season. The Lakers adding a terrific talent, frontliner in Anthony Davis. He also signed just a couple years away from, you know, back being an NBA star, DeMarcus Cousins. They have a young, terrific talent in Kyle Kuzma. But the Clippers getting the top of the class of the free agency with Kawhi Leonard, and also getting Paul George to come from Oklahoma City in a big trade to play for his hometown, L.A. Clippers. Our line's open for you at 866-893-KPCC. Miriam Swanson, Clippers staff writer for SoCal News Group, and Dan Wykey, NBA writer, national NBA writer for the Los Angeles Times. What in the case of the Lakers, Dan, do you think is going to be the biggest challenge for them? I mean, one of the things I'm thinking about is that there's been so much criticism of the organization itself and Jeannie Buss's ownership and Rob Pelinka's general managership of the team. Is this all stuff that has a hangover onto possible play on the court?
Well, I mean, I think it shows up in other ways, right? I do think that, generally speaking, you want ownership ideally to be engaged in the sense and willing to spend, but then you generally don't want to hear about them, right? Like, that's sort of the best case scenario when it comes to management. And we've heard a lot about Laker management over the last 3 years. And, you know, starting with Jeannie Buss kind of usurping her brothers, moving on to her hiring Magic Johnson and Rob Pelinka, and then, you know, going forwards with Magic Johnson's surprise resignation. I think it speaks to an instability inside the organization. And there's a sense that they're more stable today with Anthony Davis on board. But remember, Anthony Davis is on a one-year contract, essentially. He can be a free agent, or he will be a free agent at the end of the season. Everybody currently expects him to re-sign. But I think there's a real pressure to make sure that everything is good and what they expect, and that, excuse me, that this team, you know, the caller mentioned the depth that the Lakers have assembled, and And there are a lot of bodies and a lot of veterans. It's a fit, though, that I'm a little skeptical of. That this is because they are shopping at kind of the back end of the market. You know, these are a lot of flawed players. It does feel a little bit like they are throwing sort of 8 to 9 year veterans against the wall, and hopefully they can find 7 that stick. It's sort of what it feels like. And I'm not saying that's even a bad strategy.
Yeah.
But that's just kind of, I think, where they're at. You know, we talked before about the Kawhi Leonard conspiracy theory. I don't think it's true, but God, do I wish it was. I think it would be so fun to have sort of this quiet. So I've heard people refer to it as like Kaiser Soze, maybe from Usual Suspects, like moving in silence and having everybody tricked. And I think this it did really affect the Lakers' ability in free agency, because if Kawhi Leonard hadn't expressed an interest, the team would have had to have made a choice. They would have chosen at the very beginning of free agency whether or not to use their salary cap space on one superstar level player, whether it be D'Angelo Russell or Jimmy Butler, that kind of talent, or whether or not they wanted to kind of split it up and try to find the right role players. And they were forced into that decision. And it very well might've been the right one. The problem is they were forced into it a week late. And by then, I think most of my, I ranked the top 40 free agents, and I think only 3 remained by the time the Lakers had to kind of get ready to shop. And they signed 2 of them, DeMarcus Cousins and Danny Green. But obviously it wasn't plan A, and it might not have even been plan B.
Who's going to be the starting point guard for the Lakers?
I mean, this is a very good question. I think it's trending to Rajon Rondo. That feels like the person that there's a stability and a familiarity there. But it was a pretty weak point guard free agent class. Particularly pretty quickly. It got weak pretty quickly. And Rajon Rondo is an older player with limitations. They signed Quinn Cook from the Warriors, who is a former undrafted free agent who can really shoot the basketball but has other sort of limitations. There's an expectation, I think, from some people who will say, well, LeBron James will do it. He'll be sort of the de facto point guard. And that might be true. The thing that would make me nervous about that is something I think people undersell. And Miriam, you've seen this too with teams, is if you have one guy who's doing most of that, like bringing the ball up the court, initiating offense and stuff like that, over the course of a season, that's a grind. And those extra 7 to 10 seconds per possession where you have to exert an energy that instead of coast, it adds up. You used to hear Chris Paul talk about this all the time in Los Angeles, how he would prefer to have almost somewhere so he could, quote, play off the ball a little bit more. And teams want to do that with their best players. And the Lakers might not have that luxury. And coming off a year where a groin injury sidelined LeBron James longer than I think people expected, keeping him healthy, like you mentioned, is going to be really important. I don't know that putting more on his plate is sort of the key to doing that.
I want to thank you both so much. That's Dan Wyke, LA Times national NBA writer, and Miriam Swanson, the beat reporter covering the LA Clippers for the Southern California News Group, with their many publications like the LA Daily News, the Long Beach Press-Telegram, and many more. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. After 67 years of publication, Mad Magazine's going into reruns. That's right. Alfred E. Newman won't have to worry about coming up with new content for Mad Magazine. A number of publications citing unnamed sources say that after the fall, Mad will only have new covers of magazines that are distributed, but with vintage content, and that there will be no more newsstand sales of Mad Magazine. Mad is an extremely influential humor publication for baby boomers like me. We grew up on Mad Magazine. It's parodies of movies and television programs. It's horrifying cliches, the cartoons of Sergio Aragonés, Spy versus Spy, Mad Magazine was a must-read for most young people of my generation, and that means the generations that followed were also heavily influenced by Mad Magazine. I'd like to hear from you your favorite memories of Mad Magazine over the years, what you liked best, what still lingers in your memory as some of the funniest satire that Mad Magazine provided. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. With me is a historian of Mad Magazine, Maria Reitelbach, who wrote Completely Mad, A History of the Comic Book and Magazine. Maria, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, hi there. It's nice to be here.
So share with us what you think of the most important legacy of Mad.
Well, I think you're right. I think on those of us who are baby boomers, it taught us how to think skeptically about what was going on around us. We grew up during the prime years when consumer culture was being manifested and becoming the mainstream culture. And Mad Magazine really took aim at consumer culture in all different directions and definitely made fun of it when it was trying to take itself so seriously.
Who are the founders of Mad, so to speak?
I would say, clearly Bill Gaines, who was the publisher, and Harvey Kurtzman, who was the original editor.
And what were their backgrounds?
Well, Bill had a really interesting background because his father was one of the inventors of the comic book. And he was an educator, and his idea was that comics would educate people. And he did picture stories from the Bible, picture stories from science. At the same time, he was kind of an awful dad. He really gave Bill a hard time and was never satisfied with anything that Bill did. So when he died in a boating accident suddenly and Bill inherited the magazine when he was 21, Bill just totally went on a tear and changed it all around, changed the name from Educational Comics to Entertaining Comics, and started publishing things like Tales from the Crypt and Weird Science and Two-Fisted Tales and Mad Comics.
And the rest is history. Maria Reitelbach with us, author of Completely Mad, A History of the Comic Book and Magazine. Again, I'd like to hear from you. And you don't have to be a comic professional, but what your most lasting memories of Mad Magazine are from your childhood or your teen years. Maybe you continued to read the magazine. I actually bought it off a newsstand for my son a few years ago, and his copy is plenty dog-eared. He found it very funny, even in recent years. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. You remember the Mad Fold-In, where it created a totally different picture than the one you were initially looking at? No fold-out. It was a fold-in. I also remember they had a little paper 45 records they'd sometimes put in of comedy records of music. 866-893-KPECC or our AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with me, cartoonist and longtime illustrator for Mad Magazine, Tom Richmond. Tom, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What are your feelings about this news about the future of Mad?
Well, certainly didn't come as a huge surprise. I mean, magazines aren't exactly doing real well these days, and that's probably Mad's chief problem, is that it's a magazine. Nothing they can do about that. But, over the years, the content and the type of humor has maintained a high level. It's just that it hasn't been finding the eyes of readers like it used to be, back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and even 90s.
Well, and of course, it was a very different popular culture landscape then, where all of us who were growing up, we watched the same television programs. We saw the same movies. There was no Netflix or Prime for films. There was no, you know, cable with all the hundreds of channels, everybody consuming different things, no YouTube. So it's a very, very different world. And even young people don't necessarily have the same cultural points of reference to easily parody. We'll continue with your phone calls. We talk about the future of Mad Magazine. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back after a live update from Hedy Lyn Erdes. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Long before there was a National Lampoon, before there was a Saturday Night Live, there was Mad Magazine, which influenced a whole generation of funny people, from writers to comedians to satirists. So much of the humor that would follow the baby boom generation was heavily influenced by Mad Magazine. It was a top-selling publication. You could get it on the newsstand, the local supermarket or drugstore, or you could subscribe to it. DC Comics, which owns Mad, announced, "We will continue to publish Mad with a mix of new and best of content from the archives. We will also continue to publish the end-of-year issue, as well as books and special collections. The magazine will no longer be on newsstands beginning this fall, but it will continue to be mailed to subscribers." So DC indicating it's largely going to be archived content. They've got decades worth of funny stuff. But of course, Mad, during its heyday of the 1960s and into the early 1970s, was really very much of the culture of that time. 866-893-KPECC. I'm joined by Kit Lively, joining us from Dallas, a writer for Mad Magazine. Kit, thanks very much. Your thoughts about this big cutback in the publication?
Hey, thanks very much. Have I wandered into a trap here?
No, definitely not.
I'm the sort of guy that somehow finds himself wandering into windowless vans here and there. So I just wanted to make sure I was in a safe
space. You're safe. You're in a safe space. Absolutely, Kit. So what your feelings about this you know, end of an era with Mad?
It's very shocking. I would even go so far as to say, sort of a depressing in a way. Now I do come from Texas, so I'm quite accustomed to being depressed.
But it's all relative.
It's even darkens the clouds even further, I think.
What do you see as the influence of Mad on comedic writers like yourself, or other people working in comedy today?
Oh gosh, for me personally, when I first saw Mad, which was probably around the age of 7 or 8, I can remember it was like a bomb went off in my head. I felt portions of my brain wake up that I think were probably not ready to wake up until maybe after puberty or something. And it was, I knew immediately that's what I was meant to do, was to draw and write funny things.
All right. Kit Lively with us, writer of Mad Magazine. Al Espinosa writes on the page, "My dad would buy Mad Magazine in Mexico, and I loved flipping through the pages, even though I didn't understand English or a lot of the subject matter at that time. I love Spy versus Spy on the edge of the pages, which didn't need much translation." Spy versus Spy was a spoof of the Cold War era, and no dialogue between the characters in a word bubble there. Was just all funny, like Wile E. Coyote versus Wile E. Coyote kind of humor. Let's talk with Maurice in Brentwood. Good to have you with us, Maurice. Your thoughts about Mad Magazine?
I grew up with that magazine, and one of the most wonderful things before my dad got transferred to going to Germany, and we had to move in Germany in the late 60s, was my grandfather gave me every copy from the beginning to what he had, which is a huge stack, but we had to put them in storage before, and I wouldn't see them until we came back from Germany. And unfortunately, they got flooded, but it was, what a wonderful publication that was. There's so much stuff I didn't understand, but kind of opened my mind up to different things.
Yeah.
And as an adult, it was just too cool, Spy versus Spy and all the other stuff in the background. It's sad to see that it's going to change. I hope it doesn't change too much.
Yeah, well, it sounds like not going to be much new content. Maurice, I appreciate it. Thanks very much. 866-893-KPECC. My next-door neighbor when I was a kid in Inglewood in the apartment next door to ours was Kevin Fagan. And so he and I grew up and you know, we shared our Mad magazines. We'd sit down, we'd read them, we'd laugh together. And Kevin went on to be the cartoonist responsible for the syndicated Drabble comic strip. And I don't know how influential Mad might have been on him. I assume quite a bit, because we sure read Mad magazine a lot when we were kids. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Mike in Monterey Park, your favorite memories of Mad?
There's so many. You mentioned one of them, the fold-in on the back page. And my brothers used to buy it, so for me, when I got to the age where I could buy it and be the first one to fold it in, that was really exciting. But one of the features they had one time was, you know you've made it when. And I'll never forget, they said, you know you've made it when you have a 7-car garage and your Corvette has to sit out in the rain.
Yeah, that would be it. Mike, thanks very much. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Rob in the Mid-Wilshire District, your favorite memories of Mad?
Larry, in your lead-in, you hit two of them. The Vinyl Tuck-In Records.
Yes.
And the Star Trek takedown. And I'll tell you, that vinyl, one of those vinyl records, I played it at my dad's stereo when we lived in Alaska, and I thought it was 85% flatulence. And it was interesting. It was funny.
I can still hear the music. I know exactly which one you're talking about. It was supposed to be Alfred E. Newman burping on that. And I can still hear the lame music that was in the background behind it. I played it so many times, it stuck in my head.
Well, unfortunately, it also stuck to the needle on my dad's stereo, and I got in so much trouble about that, and I never was sure whether I was listening to the record or I was listening to what I'd done to my dad's stereo. And on the other side of it is, on the Star Trek thing, when they beamed down Spock, and he had all these body parts coming out of inappropriate parts of his orifices, and he said, he beamed up to the captain or Scotty, I think we have a problem.
Yeah, I remember that was Star Black or something like that was the spoof that they did. Rob, I appreciate the memories. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. TRH tweets at AirTalk, Mad Magazine was a rite of passage in my family. Every kid got a subscription for a 12th birthday. So much fun. 866-893-KPECC. Also with me, editor-in-chief of the Satire magazine, Weekly Humorist, and founder of Humorist Media, Marty Dundix. Marty, thank you for being with us. You were with the National Lampoon for a decade or so. How influential was Mad on the Lampoon?
Oh, very. It was very influential on the Lampoon. I mean, Mad started in the 50s, and Lampoon didn't get started until the mid to late 70s. And they kind of took it up a notch into more of an adult longer fiction, a lot more writing, more dense text. And Mad Magazine stayed very art-centric with writing from the beginning until now. Very consistent tone, very consistent voice, art always absolutely top-notch. It never really went up and down the way that other major magazines did over, you know, this amazing run of 67 years. And maybe it's not the end. Hopefully, there's a lot of Twitter chatter about saving Mad Magazine. So I know I just resubscribed yesterday. So maybe
you've
people
done your
will...
part. Yeah,
I've done my part. People can subscribe. I was very influenced. My dad was a huge Mad fan in the 50s and 60s, and he was a big Don Martin fan.
Yes.
And so I had all these old books when I was little that were way above my intellectual capabilities, but I would soak them in, and then I eventually got my own subscription when I was in my maybe 11s or 12s. And I had that subscription until I was graduated from Syracuse.
All right. Marty Dundix with us, editor-in-chief of the satire magazine Weekly Humorist. You know, one of the things that Mad did so well is it had just a bit of the transgressive, like you need for good satire or pointed satire, but it didn't go so far into outrageousness that parents would confiscate Mad magazines and leave their kids without it. 866-893-KPCC. We'll be back with more as we remember Mad Magazine in just 1 minute. Mad Magazine is going to cease distribution at newsstands. It'll continue to be mailed to subscribers with new covers, but sounds like most of the content is going to be from the archives. Not new content at Mad. Obviously, the magazine business has changed dramatically. American Humorist has evolved a great deal. But Mad Magazine, in its heyday, post-war America for baby boomers, a huge impact. I think you could argue the effect on American comedy has continued to this day, particularly in satirical work. We're at 866-893-KPECC as we remember Mad Magazine. Nikki in Pasadena, what's your favorite memory of Mad?
Hi, Larry. I think this was from maybe the mid-80s, and it was a fold-out, like a centerpiece, and it was called the Organization Board of the United States Government. And it had column after column after column, complicated, lots of little departments and units. And then it got to the United States Postal Service. And under that, it said Bob and Joe.
I love it. That's perfect. Nikki, thanks. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Steve in Sherman Oaks, welcome.
Hi, Larry. I just want to let you know I'm an acting teacher at Roxbury Park in Beverly Hills. And I was so fortunate to have a student join our class a couple of years ago. His name is Larry Siegel, and he was the staff writer for Mad Magazine. And so we were just incredibly, you know, fortunate to have him bring in so much of his writing, his comedy writing. He did a lot of things other than writing for Mad Magazine. And we were able to put a lot of his sketches and little scenes on, and he was just an incredible writer. I haven't seen him for a while. He was quite sick, but what a connection. And like everybody else, I just adored Mad Magazine as a kid.
Well, and you were able to see firsthand the kind of talented people who made it such a must-read for those of us. Steve, I appreciate it very much. In Sherman Oaks, we bring into our conversation an artist and writer for Mad Magazine and president of the National Cartoonist Society, Jason Chatfield. Jason, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Just your thoughts about the cultural significance of Mad in its history.
Yeah, I think it goes without saying that, I mean, based on the calls you've been getting, that its influence was wide and far. It influenced a lot of comedy writers and comedians, including myself. I read it when I was a kid back in Perth in Western Australia, and it was sort of my window into the world. And I was lucky enough to finally become a contributor to Mad. And see that influence had you know, sort of come to fruition and turned into a job.
Well, given that you're an artist, can you speak to the Mad artists and the aspects of their work that you think were most significant?
It was genuinely one of the best collections of American artists, in fact, international artists, that you'll ever find, I think, anywhere in history, including who you had on earlier, Tom Richmond. You have this amazing collection of people who basically influenced an entire several generations of artists now, people like Don Martin and Mort Drucker and Sergio Aragonés and these artists who had their own styles that were so different than anything else that you would find in any other publication. That, to me, was probably the biggest takeaway, apart from the incredible writing, was the artwork. You know, I learned to draw by reading Mad.
Wow. That was your school. That is fascinating.
I never went to art school. I just subscribed to Mad.
So, Jason, before I let you go, how are you feeling about this announcement? It's a little squishy, but it sounds like not much new content will be coming.
That's right. Once they're basically going to see out the subscriptions with old content, and then they'll discontinue the magazine. What is most sad to me was that, I mean, it's tragic that there's going to be entire generations growing up now without Mad as part of their world. And the reboot in California was actually going a long way to finding an exciting new and young audience. But unfortunately, DC fired their editor this January, who is at the head of that venture. So unfortunately, it took a bit of a nosedive, and here we are.
All right. Jason, thank you. Really appreciate your talking with us. He's president of the National Cartoonist Society, contributor as an artist and writer for Mad Magazine. Let me take another listener call here. Let's see. This is Marlene in Silver Lake. Marlene, your memories of Mad.
Oh, hi. I wish I'd tuned into this earlier. Mad really set my tone for my sense of humor. I never missed an issue. I think my mother finally got rid of them, unfortunately. But my fifth grade class at the University of Chicago Lab School loved Mad Magazine, and we actually performed a version of East Side Story, which is a mashup of West Side Story. And I think I can still remember a verse. Let's see if I can keep it in the lyric. Life is a whiz in America. Eddie met Liz in America. Thought she was his in America. Well, that's showbiz in America.
They did parodies of The Sound of Music, so many others. Marlene, thanks very much. Let's talk with Rob in Laguna Hills. Your memory of Mad Magazine. Rob, you there? No?
Yeah, Rob, I'm sorry. Yes, I love Mad Magazine. I'm the one that remembered The Sound of Money, they called it. But I really want to agree with you that we've lost our common sense of references. You know, everybody can watch exactly the news they want and not hear the news they don't. Everybody can have so many films and television shows to choose from. You can't just assume everybody watched, you know, Ed Sullivan or whatever.
Yeah.
Star Trek. And that's the problem. It's impaired our ability to communicate with each other. But I love Mad Magazine. Read it in the 60s and 70s as a kid, and I will miss it.
All right, Rob. I appreciate it. Ken tweets at Air Talk, my dad laughed so hard once at Spy versus Spy, he got a hernia from it. Oh, Ken, what a lasting memory of Mad Magazine. Aaron in Pomona says, my dad kept his Mad issues from the 1950s, so I grew up reading those. Then I bought my own issues in the 90s, Aaron said. So it was not just a connection to my dad, but I also learned a lot about the culture of the 1950s and 60s. That's Aaron in Pomona. Michael in Long Beach says, I was introduced at 8 years of age by my mom while I was homesick. And then I brought the magazine to my Catholic school and was reading it after a test one day. I got in trouble. My nemesis turned me in. That's Michael in Long Beach. And Ned in Brentwood says, I'm 75. I remember when Mad first came out, my brother brought it home. I read it all the way through like a comic book. And read it until my early 20s. It taught me to be skeptical about TV and movies. That's Ned in Brentwood. And Mark in Burbank remembers an insert that was a parody of TV Guide called TV Guys with all kinds of fake names of shows. Mark, thanks for that. From all of us at Air Talk, have a great afternoon.